This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back more than 100 years to revisit the audacious crimes of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Women who were trying to make it in a world made for men. What do their lives and their crimes tell us about women in the past? And how different is it for women today? Now, we've all heard distressing stories of women having their drinks spiked by men who then rob or sexually assault them. Today, I'm investigating Elizabeth Manning, a young woman in 1860s London, who turns this notion on its head.
If I'm a married man, it's the first I've heard of it. The marriage must have taken place while I was in a state of unconsciousness.
I should like a little drop of gin. Will you lend me a shilling to send for some?
I partook of half a glass. I became unconscious for several minutes, and on recovering, I was missing me watch and chain, me ring, and 23 shillings from me pocket.
I want to know, how does Elizabeth Manning go about spiking her victims? How common is spiking in Victorian England? And what can Elizabeth's story tell us about this crime today? To help me answer these questions, I am delighted to be joined by our guest detective, the barrister, Neka Akudolu, KC. Neka, welcome back to Lady Swindlers.
Thank you very much for having me, Lucy.
It's a pleasure. Now, Neka, have you worked on any spiking cases during your legal career?
I have. Unfortunately, it's something that's become a lot more prevalent in recent years.
Yes.
Where, you know, a substance is introduced to an individual's drink or food to incapacitate a person, usually for a criminal purpose, and it's done without consent. Causes a lot of damage and trauma to all the victims.
Let's hear what happened in this particular case. It's September 1863, and Elizabeth Manning is embarking upon a swindling career when she steals a £20 note from a medical student. His story is that she seduced him, returned to his lodgings with him, then drugged him. When she's arrested for the theft, she's discovered to be in the company of a sailor from the Royal Navy, who is in a strange and partially stupefied state. When he's sufficiently recovered, the sailor claims that he has spent £100 on jewellery for Elizabeth while semi-conscious. At which point, Elizabeth produces, to the sailor's very great surprise, a certificate of marriage by special licence, which is almost certainly a fake. Poor chap. Sensibly, he runs away back to sea and away from Elizabeth as fast as he can. Neka, what these two men experience at the hands of Elizabeth is known at the time as hocusing. It's an interesting word with there's a sort of implication of witchcraft, hocus pocus, bewitching with evil potions. That's not a word that's still in use today, right?
No. What it's commonly referred to now is spiking or needling.
Oh, needling is needling, a thing too.
It is absolutely a thing. It's more frequently happening in nightclubs these days where someone is pricked with a needle. And the effect is that they are incapacitated within usually a very short space of time.
You can really see where hocusing comes from because it's putting the person under a spell,
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. Young people, don't go to the nightclub, go to the library instead. That's advice from Auntie Lucy. To find out more about Elizabeth Manning and about hocusing, I met our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, just off the Edgware Road in central London, where Elizabeth was living in lodgings in the mid-1860s. Now, Elizabeth lived at number 4 Tichborne Street. It's now disappeared. We've got some huge blocks of modern flats where it was. What kind of an area was this in Elizabeth's day, Ros?
Well, it was a very busy area and also quite diverse. I brought with me a map, here we go, of the area in the 1860s. Now, as you can see, we've got Edgware Road running along here. And there was quite a bit of affluence in this area. There's nice rows of housing here, but it's always the case in Victorian London that you also get pockets of mixed housing where the poor live, quite close to where the wealthy live. And I also have with me a copy of the census from 1861. And here we've got people renting individual rooms. There are lots of lodgers on this street in particular.
And what about Elizabeth herself? Do we know much about her family?
We don't know very much. We know she was born in or around 1844, probably in London. We think she got married in about 1863 to a man called Arthur Coulthard or Coulthard. What we do know is by her late teens, she has been convicted of several crimes in central London. Then by 1863, she already has two known victims of hocusing, the medical student and the sailor.
So she's a bad un. Could you tell me exactly what kind of drugs are being put into the drinks then?
Most likely it's opium in the form of laudanum. Yeah, laudanum was widely available and relatively cheap. But some hocusers also used drugs like morphine or even chloroform.
Yeah.
Poisons that could be easily disguised in a drink. Odourless and tasteless.
So women can be physically weak but pharmacologically strong. And how common is it, do we know?
It's really difficult to say how common it was because in the case of male victims hocused by women, it might have been an underreported crime.
Because they were embarrassed, right?
That's right, yeah. If men thought they'd been made fools of and tricked by a woman. And there's also the association of this crime with prostitution. So it's often assumed that men who were hocused were in the company of these women because they were hoping to buy sex. And in this case, it looks like Elizabeth's modus operandi is the promise of sex. So she meets men in pubs, she seduces them, and then she drugs them. She might well have been working as a prostitute too, but we should never make that assumption. What we should take away from this is that she seems to have found a way to make money from these men without having to have sex with them. Yeah, I mean, it's a really clever trick, isn't it? So women could steal from men without having to use physical force, and they had enough time while their victim was unconscious to really search through their pockets and to retrieve items that men kept very close to their bodies.
Yes.
They're not in a rush, and they can get far away before the victim regains consciousness.
Ooh, I'm quite drawn to this career. Necker. Ros was describing the Victorian poisons that Elizabeth used to spike her victims. What substances do people use today?
Well, they're commonly known as date rape drugs. So one of those is GHB. Rohypnol, another one, and ketamine. They all have generally sedative effects, which do tend to incapacitate an individual within a very short period of time.
Are they all illegal, I guess, and how do you get hold of them?
Some of them have very legal purposes. GHB, for example, is manufactured for individuals who actually suffer from narcolepsy, and ketamine is commonly used in equestrian veterinary practice.
Do spiking cases present particular problems for prosecutors?
Oh, absolutely. A national survey from Drink Aware reported that in 2023, around 2.2% of UK adults reported having their drinks spiked, equating to around 1.2 million UK adults.
That's amazing.
That is amazing, but we certainly don't have anywhere near 1.2 million people reporting. And that's the issue, because a lot of people, probably as high as 90%, feel that there is no point. Firstly, embarrassment. Secondly, just believing that there's no point because, well, how are they even supposed to even begin to ascertain who the perpetrator was? If you're in a busy nightclub, it can be extremely easy to slip something into someone's drink undetected. And then another reason is the fact that these substances don't actually stay in our system for very long.
Oh.
GHB, for example, will be detected within a urine sample for a period of 12 hours.
Oh, that's not long to get the evidence.
That is not long, where they are thinking whether I should go to the police or not. And so, as in a lot of cases, it has already completely passed through an individual system before they even get to the police station.
Mm. Very interesting. Yeah, so you've got to be as quick as you can if you think it's happened to you. And yet, at the same time, there's a huge psychological hurdle to overcome.
Absolutely.
Can you explain the UK government's proposed new anti-spiking legislation?
Yes. Well, at the moment, there's general legislation under the Offences Against the Persons Act. Laws from 1861 that are covering this particular offence that really need to be dragged into the 21st century. But what the Crime and Policing Bill is seeking to do is to make it a specific offence. So it's about time.
Mm. Now back to Elizabeth Manning. The medical student and the sailor don't press charges. But the big question is, will Elizabeth's luck eventually run out? During the gloomy late afternoon of the 20th of December 1864, a cabbie called James Rintoul is driving his hansom cab, that's a little carriage with a horse, past the end of Baker Street. He's hailed by a smartly dressed young woman, our Elizabeth. Let's retrace their journey.
Hello, you three?
Yes, certainly.
Could you take me down to the other end of Baker Street, please?
Certainly, jump in.
Thank you. At the other end of Baker Street, she gets out. She asks him to wait because she has an appointment to meet a gentleman. You okay hanging on?
That's all right, no problem.
Thanks. After 10 minutes or so, she's back. Next, she asks James Rintoul to take her to Regent Circus. Can you manage that, sir?
Yeah, I think so.
Next, she wants to go to a pastry cook's.
Off we go.
And then to Haymarket. There, she gets out and she goes into a cafe. She stays in the cafe for some time. And finally, she asks the very patient Mr. Rintoul to take her home. Can we go to 4 Tichborne Street, please?
No problem. Jump in.
Home.
By this time, Elizabeth's run up a pretty big fare. But when they get to her lodgings just off the Edgware Road, she says she doesn't have enough money to pay. So he says he'll come back for it later. If I were Mr. Rintoul, I'd be pretty fed up by this stage. When he arrives at Elizabeth's, she opens the front door and turns on the charm.
Oh, dear. Bless me. You are a knobby swell. A perfect sweet. You look like a real gentleman. Do walk in.
A knobby swell. Isn't that the most fabulous compliment? What would that be today, do you think?
Probably, you know, the young people like to say a salty potato or a sort.
Is that what they say on Love Island?
Apparently, yes.
Oh, well, come on. I know you watch it.
You do. Yes, I do. That's the sort of thing they say. He's a sort.
A knobby swell. Now, I'm a bit anxious that Elizabeth is potentially putting herself in danger by luring this Mr. Rintoul back into her lodgings. Or is she totally in control of the situation? What do you think?
I think she's totally in control and she knows exactly what she's about to do. And she's sort of exploiting the sort of expectation of femininity and womanhood, because she'd done this already a number of times. And it's like many people who find themselves entangled in the criminal justice system, you don't get caught the first time.
Okay, I don't feel sorry for her. I'm on his side.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long-simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Let's find out what happens next. Well, James Rintoul claims he's reluctant to go inside Elizabeth's house, but he does. She says...
Oh, by the by, I should like a little drop of gin. And so would my landlady. Will you lend me a shilling to send for some, and then I will pay you back for your fare? Oh, you are a swell.
James reluctantly agrees to lend her even more money, and Elizabeth sends her landlady out for the gin.
I partook of half a glass, and it seemed to burn my mouth. But I became unconscious for several minutes, and on recovering, I was missing my watch and chain, my ring, and 23 shillings from my pocket.
Also missing is Elizabeth. When James comes to, he's alone in a dark room. He staggers downstairs and he pleads with the landlady's husband.
My property must be returned. I must have it, or it will ruin me for life with my wife.
So, after he's picked up his wife from work, they go back together to Tichborne Street and they wait for Elizabeth to return to the house. They wait until 5 o'clock in the morning, but she doesn't appear. After a couple of days, which were possibly rather tense in the Rintoul household, James finally tracks Elizabeth down back at Tichborne Street and hands her over to the police. Or at least that's his story, the one he gives at Marylebone Police Court a few days later. But when Elizabeth stands up to give her evidence, she has a rather different version of events, one that's unlikely to please Mrs. Rintoul.
I took him home, and he said he had no money. And I told him I have a very heavy rent to pay, and I can't have gentlemen there for nothing. So he gave me his watch and his ring, and 23 shillings.
The magistrate remands her in custody and sends her for trial. Now, Necker, let's draw upon your barrister experience here. Is this a defence that you would advise Elizabeth to make? She says Mr. Rintoul was after sex, was actually her client, and that he owed her money.
You've got to remember that in these circumstances, we are dealing with one person's word against another. And so in order to create some doubt as to her guilt, she's putting forward a defence that actually the reason he's lying is because he's married. He plainly doesn't want to admit to his wife that he wanted to have sex with Elizabeth. And that's the reason why he's concocted this elaborate story of her drugging him and then robbing him.
It does all make sense though, doesn't it?
I would possibly run that defence. I've ran worse.
What do you think here and now? Do you believe her story or Mr. Rintoul's?
No, absolutely not. No,
because I actually feel a bit sorry for Mr. Rintoul. Look, he's been robbed. He's lost his fare from all of that driving around. He's worried that he's in trouble with his wife now. And this is the killer. He even paid for the gin that knocked him out. She should have had you on her side, Necker. But at her trial, the actual court believes Mr. Rintoul's version of events, and Elizabeth gets sentenced to 7 years of penal servitude. That's imprisonment with hard labour. In 1869, she's released on licence 2 years early, but just a year later, she's back in prison with a 10-year sentence for, guess what, hookersing a Buckinghamshire farmer in a pub. She's released on license in 1878, but oh no! She's back in prison again in 1880 with a 5-year sentence for stealing a watch and chain. I met up with Ros Crone outside Brixton Prison in South London to find out more about Elizabeth's stays at Her Majesty's pleasure.
Ros and I are stood in the shadow of the walls of Brixton Prison, and they are proper prison walls. They're really high. They're sort of blackened. Today it's a men's prison, but when Elizabeth was there, it was female, wasn't it, Ros?
Yes, that's right, Lucy. Brixton Prison opened as a convict women's prison in 1853. And there was a real concerted effort at this time to create a penal regime specifically for women, because there was a desire to tame and domesticate these criminal women, to make them good wives and mothers or domestic servants, to make them good women. Now, I've brought with me a few pictures of what the prison looked like at the time. Okay, so you see here, are the cells. Each woman had their own cell.
You can see the
bed, little desk for writing, some shelving.
There's her cup and plate.
Yes, that's right.
A tiny window.
And here we've got female convicts at work doing their tasks of knitting and sewing. And other forms of labour in the prison included laundry. Okay, so
yes.
You have to imagine how hot and steamy and uncomfortable it would have been to work in there.
Heavy labour.
And it's interesting, what we know from the criminal records at the time is that she learnt to iron.
Elizabeth did?
Yes, to become an ironer. And also she learnt to read and write in the prison too.
Ah, interesting. So she's getting an education.
I have with me for you to see today, Lucy, Elizabeth Manning's penal records. And you'll also be pleased to see that among those, I have some photographs. Okay, so here she is.
She is. Look, she's looking rather frightened.
Yeah, that's her in 1870.
It says here in the written description that she's under 5 feet tall, blue eyes, a sallow complexion. Well, you would be if you were locked up. And she's described as being stout and strong. Strong to work in a laundry.
And the records also suggest that especially during her first two sentences, she was quite a troublesome prisoner. So I have with me a list of her prison offences. There we go.
She's kicking violently at cell door. Poor lady. She's destroyed her bedding. She's broken 30 panes of glass. And she has used threatening language.
It's actually quite typical of a lot of female prison records at the time. Certainly contemporaries, officials, prison officials spoke about how women were more difficult to control. Female prisoners were more difficult to control than male prisoners.
Gosh.
I've got this as well to show you. This is a record of the letters she was writing. Here's her second sentence, and this is interesting, because we see correspondence with her husband.
Her husband?
Yeah, yeah. Ah. So she's writing to him.
Yes,
he's writing back. But it soon gets quite sad. He stops writing back. And you can see her letter here is returned because he has gone away. So they've obviously lost contact.
He's given up on her.
Yeah, he's given up on her.
Ros Crone has now joined us in the studio. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Necker.
Ros, Elizabeth Manning was in and out of prison a lot. Today we call her a serial offender. Was that a common thing amongst women offenders in the Victorian period?
Yes, well, Elizabeth Manning served 6 prison sentences over 20 years, a long time in prison. Now, according to official records, while women in Victorian society were less likely than men to be prosecuted for crime, once they were convicted, they were more likely to become repeat offenders.
Why would that be? That's so interesting.
Their criminal record was seen to be more detrimental than it was for men. So, for example, male criminals who were released from prison could be employed in outdoor jobs like unskilled labouring, etc. But women were more likely to be employed inside in positions of trust, like in domestic service. And having a criminal record was a real disadvantage. People didn't want to hire you. And so to survive, they went back to crime. Men are much more likely to start their offending young and then to desist, whereas women at this time were much more likely to offend across the life cycle. So if you're not connected to a man
through marriage, through family, you're out on your own. You're paid less. It's harder to keep a roof over your head, to keep your children fed if you're a single mother. And in reality, repeat offending was really about poverty, limited opportunities, and ultimately women trying to make it and survive in a world that was made by men for men.
Mm, that's fascinating. Roz, what is the end of Elizabeth's story?
Aha, I brought some documents along to show you both. Yeah. You can see here in her penal record that during her final sentence, Elizabeth writes to a religious charity and through them she applies to emigrate, to leave the country. And permission is granted. She leaves prison on the 12th of November, 1883. She arrives in New York on the 4th of December and she is 39 years old. What we need to remember, Elizabeth's in a pretty dire position. Her husband's deserted her. She has no visits from anyone. So immigration was looking fairly attractive, this idea of a clean start.
And do we know anything about her new life in America?
Oh, sadly not, Lucy. At this point, she completely disappears from the historical record.
Neka, what do you take away from this whole story?
What I take away is just how many times this woman went back to prison, which is something I just don't see very often in the modern day criminal justice system. There was something very troubling happening in the mid to late Victorian era.
Yes, this is one area where things are better than they were.
Definitely. Thankfully, yes. I think it's very important as well that education about what you should expect if there is a spiking incident so that people can have the confidence to go to the police so that the evidence can be gathered as quickly as possible because that is so important. And then the police can work very quickly in trying to identify potential perpetrators, but it's very heavily reliant on individuals coming forward, which, as we see from the statistics, a lot of people don't.
Roz, what do you take away from this story?
My suspicion is that this case of Elizabeth Manning reveals a whole area of female criminal activity that was underreported in the Victorian period. And with the exception of the historian Lucy Williams, who's written about this in her book Wayward Women, this area has been virtually ignored by criminal justice historians. We need to reorientate our focus away from this image of the domestic female poisoner who murdered her family members for money or her husband for revenge or for her freedom. It's important that we recognise the range of uses for poison in this period.
Now, although we've been back in the 1860s with this case, this does feel like a very modern story, doesn't it? We just don't know how many men Elizabeth hocused, how many times she got away with it, but I would guess quite a lot. She seemed to have real nerve. And this is a risky, up-close type of property crime. I wonder what sort of a life Elizabeth made for herself in New York. Did she start a new, respectable career? Or was there a sudden rash of men in New York waking up with nasty headaches and empty pockets? Well, a huge thank you to Neka Akadolu-Casey and Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time, we're joined by author and podcaster Naomi Alderman to discuss how some of our lady swindlers use their unique powers. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble, and Alex Phelps. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long-simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.